As Congress debates whether or not to bail out the Detroit automakers, this question remains. Does Detroit have what it takes to create a new kind of car for the 21st century? In California's Silicon Valley, a small startup company called Tesla Motors has already done it. They've built an all-electric sports car that travels long distances on a single charge. Here's the catch. It costs more than $100,000, but cheaper models are on Tesla's drawing board. Like Ford, GM, and Chrysler, though, Tesla faces economic challenges and an uncertain future. Tonight, in the first of two stories, NPR's John McChesney explains why reinventing the car isn't so easy.
In an upscale showroom in Menlo Park, California, a low-slung, sleek black sports car crouches on the floor. Manager Jeremy Cleland shows off some of the car's features.
This here is a 2008 Tesla Roadster. Now, this car here is 100% electric. Operates off of a lithium-ion battery pack that has 6,831 individual commodity cells. We get 244 miles per charge with this vehicle.
Cleland calls them commodity batteries because they're just like the ones you find in laptops. That kind of battery made this car possible. The Roadster was largely the brainchild of Martin Eberhardt, who developed the first electronic book reader back in the 1990s.
Remember that 5 years ago when we started Tesla Motors, there was two things that everybody in the world knew about electric cars. One was that they sucked, and the other was that they were dead.
They were dead because California, under pressure from Detroit, had dropped the electric car from its zero emissions mandate, and the Big Three immediately shut down their EV operations. GM even recalled and crushed all of its EV1s. At about the same time, Eberhardt had decided that electricity, rather than hydrogen, was the propulsion fuel of the future. He and his co-founders decided to target a niche not occupied by Detroit.
And create a new segment of high-performance sports cars for the people that love them, but also for people who actually care about oil consumption and care about their footprint on the earth. And with that, if we succeed with that, we build a brand that allows us to move into other segments of the market.
With a carbon fiber skin made in France, and an aluminum frame made by Lotus in England, and 1,000 pounds of batteries made in Asia, the Tesla Roadster was born after a very difficult labor period.
Is that brake line clear right there on that side?
Today, the shells are flown in across the Atlantic, and the powertrains are installed here.
Made by hand.
Exactly.
No assembly line for the Tesla yet. Three workers roll around under a car, lifting the 1,000-pound battery pack into place. After the batteries comes the drivetrain, an electric motor attached to the transmission. The remarkably small, gleaming motors are lined up here on a bench. They're about the size of a big watermelon. Elon Musk is CEO of Tesla.
Tesla designed motor is the highest power-to-weight motor and highest efficiency motor in the world for this application. Our motor is capable of putting out 300 horsepower, but if you were to look at an industrial 300 horsepower motor, it's the size of a small refrigerator.
So, of course, we had to go for a ride to see what this $110,000 machine could do. We were accompanied by Rachel Conrad, a publicist for the company. A few beeps tell you the car is on, otherwise you wouldn't know, it's so quiet. And Rachel Conrad has a lead foot.
Put it in drive. It's a single-speed transmission. And unlike a Lamborghini or a Ferrari or some vehicle where you really need a lot of driving skill in order to get to peak performance, we like to say 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds, and even your grandma can drive 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds because it's just...
That's pretty amazing.
Like a slingshot, and just as quiet. No exhaust blast, just a gutsy whine when you floor it. Tesla has delivered just 70 Roadsters and hopes to produce 1,500 next year and then begin producing a lower-priced sedan in 2011. But the company is struggling, and it's had to lay off workers recently. Dan Neal writes about the automotive industry for the Los Angeles Times.
I think Tesla has dramatically changed the mental landscape of the electric car. And it was a fascinating proposal, an electric sports car. Use the sex and glamour and cachet of sports cars to push this technology forward and then generalize it with a family sedan.
But Neal is skeptical that the company will be able to deliver on its dream.
I think that it's a very close call whether they will achieve even half of what they've claimed they will achieve.
Tomorrow, we'll look at another Silicon Valley startup that's planning an infrastructure for electric cars. John McChesney, NPR News, San Francisco.
That was a piano, but playing Guitar Hero doesn't necessarily seem like something that would add to the problem of climate change. But all those hours spent with the Wii, the Xbox, the Sony PlayStation, they use up a lot of energy.
Americans spend over $1 billion each year to power up their video game consoles, but it doesn't have to be that way. That's the finding of a new report out today from the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're joined now by the NRDC's Noah Horowitz. And Noah, can you give us a rough sense of exactly how much electricity these video game consoles use?
Yes, when you add it up, nationwide, these video game consoles are using as much electricity each year as the entire city of San Diego.
That's a lot of electricity. And you note in your report that part of it is that it's not like your TVs where when you're done using it, you turn it off. People kind of forget to turn these games off.
That's exactly right. And they're completely unaware that that thing will continue to chug away at near full power all day and all night long. It's like bringing two new refrigerators into your home each year and paying the electric bill for them.
Now, I'm not an avid gamer, Noah, but I think part of the problem here, too, isn't it that sometimes you can lose your place unless you leave that video game player on?
That's exactly right.
Do any of these video game players have a function that would automatically turn things off, like much the way that your computer goes to sleep? Is that an option?
Buried in the menu of these devices, there is this auto power down feature. It's really important not only when you're playing video games, but if you play a movie and forget to turn off your game console, that thing's going to continue to chug away at 100 plus watts.
The overall number of video game consoles in the U.S. has been increasing. What about the machines themselves? As they get more high tech, are they using more electricity to run?
The Nintendo Wii has stayed around 20 watts. But the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3 have become souped-up computers. They now have internet capability. You can play games over the internet. You can download and play movies. As a result, those use a whole lot more power than the prior generation.
There's an environmental impact of this, too. What does all this electricity use mean in terms of carbon dioxide emissions?
If we just get people to turn off their video game when they're done, we could cut our nation's electric bill by about $1 billion. And from an environmental point of view, if everybody were to do that, that's like removing all the global warming pollution from the cars in San Jose, which ironically is our nation's high-tech capital.
So how do you get people to do that? What are you calling for consumers to do?
We hope people will turn off their video game once they're aware, hey, I'm spending over $100 a year to power something that I'm not even using. Secondly, we want the game industry to get together with the people that make the games and find a way to automatically save the game and your place so when it does go into sleep mode, it wakes up just like your computer exactly where you left it.
And what about the gaming industry? Have they said anything in response to this? Are they willing to work with you?
Our study, quite frankly, has served as a wake-up call to them, and they're listening. And we're hoping that the next generation of video games will be a whole lot more energy efficient.
Noah, do you yourself play video games?
I'm actually a former player of Pong, but I haven't graduated to the current generation of video games.
Noah Horowitz of the Natural Resources Defense Council, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The housing market is in crisis, banks are failing, the auto industry is begging to be rescued, and recently things aren't looking all too good for the tech sector either. Yahoo founder Jerry Yang recently announced he'll be stepping down as CEO after months of sagging profits. Google shares hit a 3-year low last week. Joining us now to share her take on the state of Silicon Valley is Carly Fiorina. She's former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and she currently runs Carly Fiorina Enterprise. She joins us now from Silicon Valley. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
It's great to be with you.
The tech industry is one that's often thought of as being recession-proof. How would you characterize its health right now?
Well, I think it very much depends on the company and your litany of woes. It is also true that Hewlett-Packard just yesterday beat expectations and is continuing to forecast growth. And I think that is in large measure because difficult decisions were made in a timely way and which positioned the company to make it through a downturn. I think there's no question that what we're seeing is a global slowdown. But I think what you will see is that the strongest companies in the technology industry, Google, Intel, Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, Cisco, these are companies that will weather these tough times. And frankly, these are also good times to make some tough decisions and emerge stronger and more competitive.
What kind of tough decisions are you talking about?
You know, when I was at Hewlett-Packard, in some ways it's akin to what the automobile industry is going through now. When I arrived at Hewlett-Packard, the only profitable line in the company was printing, and the conventional wisdom was that that was just fine. We made some very tough decisions, acquired Compaq to bolster the profitability of our computing and our services lines. It was a tough call. It was a tough choice. It was against the conventional wisdom at the time. But on the other hand, it positioned us to emerge from what was then a slowdown, the dot-com bust, as a very, very strong competitor. And I think the automobile companies now are facing a situation in which they didn't move quickly enough. They're now in a slowing economy. They are in such tough straits that they're going to the government and asking to be bailed out.
You mentioned the announcement that came out yesterday, Hewlett-Packard, that it's looking like quarterly earnings are going to surpass Wall Street's expectations. This comes several years after your departure from that company. Does it sting at all for you personally to see the company now, Hewlett-Packard, doing so well and you're not there to maybe enjoy some of the successful times?
Oh, I'm very proud that the company is doing so well. I'm delighted for the people. It's a great company with great people, and I'm very privileged to have had the opportunity to lead that company during a tough time so that it can prosper as it has for so many years, and I'm quite sure it will continue to prosper.
Carly Fiorina, you recently served as an advisor to Senator John McCain in his campaign. I'm curious, you know, throughout your career, many people have said that you do quite a good job running for public office. After this most recent experience, have you thought about considering a career in politics?
Well, I am considering a number of options. That is one of them. I get asked that question so many times that you sort of have to step back and think about it.
You made note of the fact that you felt as if vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin was not given fair treatment. Do you have any concerns as a woman about what it would be like for you running for office?
Well, let me be clear and say that I thought both Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin were subjected to a kind of discussion that men would not be. I think it is true that women in positions of authority are spoken about differently than are men. On the other hand, I have never let other people's caricatures or characterizations of me determine my choices. And so I think you just accept that that's part of the territory still.
Carly Fiorina is the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. She currently runs Carly Fiorina Enterprises. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Since last week's installment of All Tech Considered, the emails have been pouring in, and as promised, we brought back our tech guru, Omar Gayaga, to answer a few of your questions. Omar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And last week, you were talking with us and showing us how to use a cell phone application to scan barcodes and comparison shop. And Omar, that spurred this question from listener John Davidson of Indianapolis.
In your last show, you featured a program called Shop Savvy, and after looking on my iPhone, I couldn't find it, and I was curious if you had any more information about the program or something similar.
Omar, what do you have to offer him?
Well, unfortunately, John, Shop Savvy is currently only available for the T-Mobile G1. That's the first cell phone to use Google's Android operating system. But the company that made Shop Savvy, a Dallas-based Big in Japan, said it has submitted an iPhone version to Apple, but the app hasn't yet been approved.
Let's just clarify here, Omar. Big in Japan is actually the name of the company. Big in Japan.
Big in Japan, based out of Dallas. One issue they said is that the camera built into the iPhone doesn't work exactly the way the camera on the G1 does, which makes barcode scanning more difficult on Apple's phone. But Big in Japan said they did find a solution to the problem and that as soon as Apple approves the app, it should be available to everyone.
But in the meantime, are there any similar applications for people who don't have a T-Mobile G1 phone?
There are some apps on the iPhone that perform similar functions, not exactly like Shop Savvy. There's one called Save Benjis, that's B-E-N-J-I-S. And PricePad both help look up reviews and prices while shopping, but without the barcode scanning, unfortunately.
Okay, Omar, here's another question. This one is from listener Marianne Snig of Monument, Colorado.
Hi, I'm a 60-year-old grandmother and a realtor, and I'm trying my best to stay on top of technology. I recently started Twittering, but there's so many different platforms to Twitter on, and there's so much to know. Can you discuss Twitter and the various platforms? Thank you.
That 60-year-old grandmother, Omar, is way ahead of me in the technology department. What can you tell her?
Well, Twitter is a service where you can tell people what you're doing using really short messages, 140 characters or less. It's like a really tiny blog that you can update whenever you want. People post messages on the web. They send text messages to post to Twitter. And the company itself has been growing really quickly over the last 2 years. And there's a lot of companies that are using Twitter to connect with their customers like Dell, Whole Foods, and Comcast. Some people think Twitter is trivial, but you'd really be surprised at how much information people can pack into those 140 characters. If you're already on Twitter like Marianne and you want to know more on how to use it effectively, I'm going to be posting some tips on the All Tech Considered blog on NPR.org.
Great. Omar, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
And when he's not helping us out, Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. If you have tech questions, and who doesn't, send them our way to go to npr.org/alltech. We'll leave you now with one last tech thought. It's time again for those Salvation Army bell ringers. But this year, you can do your own ringing with your cell phone. In select cities, you can now keep the change and donate by text message. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
NPR Business News starts with a big internet shakeup. Internet search engine Yahoo is searching for a new CEO. The current chief executive, Jerry Yang, is stepping down. Yang co-founded the company, but he's only been CEO for a year and a half. During his short tenure, he infuriated shareholders by putting the kibosh on a deal with Microsoft, which offered to buy Yahoo for $31 a share. Yahoo's stock price is now trading at a third of that. With Yang leaving the corner office, some say a deal with Microsoft is inevitable. Though Yang isn't going too far, the 40-year-old will stay with the company and he'll have a seat on the board.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. It's time now for our weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered. Last week, we explained how to scan barcodes and comparison shop with your cell phone. This week, we go shopping for televisions. Flat screens deliver dazzling pictures, but they also eat up lots of electricity. Earlier this month, the government released its new Energy Star efficiency standards for TVs, and we asked NPR's Richard Harris to put them to the test.
If you're shopping for a new dishwasher, you can read that yellow Energy Guide label to figure out how much electricity it'll consume. No such luck if you're shopping for a glitzy new widescreen TV. Some TVs do have the Energy Star efficiency sticker, but Noah Horowitz from the Natural Resources Defense Council says even that has been misleading.
Energy Star was woefully behind on TVs. In order to earn the Energy Star label, it only dealt with how much power did the TV consume when it was off.
That has just changed. For the first time, Energy Star ratings consider the power TVs use while they're actually on. And that means that now, for the first time, you can go to the web to look up the power consumption of TV sets that make the Energy Star list. So we took that list and a meter for measuring electricity consumption to a Meyer Emco TV shop in Clarendon, Virginia.
This one should be easy to test out.
Brian Wells, the assistant manager, started off with a 50-inch plasma TV, a Pioneer Elite. We plug it into the meter.
And you're reading wattage right now, is that?
Yes. Right now we're idling at about 390 watts.
390 watts. Wow. That's like turning on 30 compact fluorescent light bulbs all at once. And if you assume that the set will be on for 5 hours a day, this set consumes more electricity than a typical refrigerator. Wells says it should do better in a slightly dimmer energy-saving mode.
So now if we turn on the energy-save mode to conserve some energy, we're at 300 watts.
And this presumably does not meet the ENERGY STAR standard.
It actually does. It's on the list.
Oh, it is on the list.
Yeah, it actually absolutely is.
The ENERGY STAR list, it turns out, doesn't single out the most efficient TVs on the market. It looks for the best within a class of TVs. And this one is relatively good for a 50-inch set. Still, your friendly neighborhood coal-burning power plant would emit half a ton of carbon dioxide every year to keep this one TV on 5 hours a day. And that's in its energy-saving mode. For comparison, I asked to look at the smallest TV in this upscale store.
So certainly a small, popular size would be about a 32-inch television. So we could easily test out one of these models.
Okay. We unplug it from the wall and plug it back into our watt meter.
All right. Well, in its brightest setting, it's pulling about 115 watts.
So that's like 2 incandescent light bulbs or 10 compact fluorescent light bulbs or 9, something like that. That's much lower power consumption than the 50-inch TV, mostly because of its size, but perhaps also because this set has an LCD screen. That technology is typically more efficient than plasma screens, like the first set we tested. So do people come in and say, I want an energy-efficient TV, or does that ever come up at all in the discussion?
It's coming up more and more often, for sure.
That's encouraging news to Noah Horowitz, who has been documenting a discouraging trend about TVs for the environmental group NRDC. He says, not only are people buying bigger and bigger TVs, the TVs are using more power, and people are watching more than ever.
It's almost like we've been dealt a losing trifecta ticket there.
The new ENERGY STAR rating system is the first step toward helping consumers make smarter choices about the TVs they buy, he says. But he's still waiting for the government to follow through on a new law that requires yellow Energy Guide stickers on every set, so people can compare easily when they shop. He says those yellow stickers are caught up in red tape at the U.S. Department of Energy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Richard has also been blogging today about his story and how your older TV may rate in the efficiency department. That's at our website, npr.org/alltech.